the movie we saw the other day had to do with differentials in wealth and power. And that's a difficult issue for a lot of Christians to come to grips with. Especially because most Christians, well, especially clergymen, find themselves in the position of being underpaid without much wealth of their own. So to get up in the pulpit and condemn other people's wealth looks a lot like envy. Those kinds of things are troublesome, I think, for Christians to deal with. I'm being bothered by a fly. I also wanted to say that there's probably several of you, or maybe I don't know how many, but may have come to these sessions because you yourself have particular interests because of your own work or things that you do in terms of your own service in the community that deal with these issues. So if you have something to contribute, please do. We all have our own separate biographies and our own experiences, and therefore we come to issues from different paths. And I'm sure that we'd be interested in what you have to share also. So if you do, you know, people tend to wait until after the session and then come up and say, somebody came up after the session the other day and said that they had been in that area that the movie was depicting, that they had lived there for a year. So I thought, they could have told us something during the session too. So feel free to speak up. Maybe I better tap on this thing so we can start. Today I wanted to focus on punishment, and specifically criminal punishment. I've told you for the last couple sessions that I've tried to present these issues in such a way that I would hope that they have some meaning to you from your own experience, or the in terms of the problems or dilemmas that maybe you see in our society, or maybe that you see in your own lives. And punishment, and criminal punishment, I think presents itself to us as a problem in these days, because there seems to be a tendency to want to send more people to prison, or to build more prisons. There's this tendency to do that. But on the other hand, we have this contradiction that we seem to see in the past, that prisons don't seem to have worked. We already lock up a large percentage of our population. Maybe some of you have seen those figures that we rank in the top three countries in the world in terms of locking people up per capita. And also the length of our prison sentences are among the longest in the world. And it seems that we've chosen this path as a way to deal with the crime problem. What else can we do? We seem to identify prison punishment with punishment, and if there doesn't seem to be an alternative that presents itself. So what can we do except build more prisons and lock more people up? Then also, from the point of view of our Christian lives, I think we're also worried that the kind of commitment that we've chosen tells us that we don't want to do just or be satisfied with just what is right. We want to sort of go beyond that and come to some understanding that would lead us to another level, another level of service. Well, first of all, what I wanted to do is to review some of a little bit of the history of punishment and the purposes of punishment, so we can get those things straight in our mind, and then look to see how punishment is used in our society. And then at the end, maybe we can deal with what we as Christians can do in terms of this issue of punishment, crime and punishment, what maybe our obligations might be. Punishment has received a bad name in recent years. although the pendulum seems to be swinging back a little bit now. I think the problems about understanding punishment come from several sources in recent times. One of these has to do with simply with the failure of prisons, the idea that prisons don't rehabilitate. So, you know, maybe punishment isn't the proper response. Also, within social psychology, there's arisen in the last couple decades a school called the labeling school. And it's sort of, the principles of this school are sort of indicated by the name labeling. It's the idea that that if you start a child out and consider that child to be a bad child, punish that child, put that child away, put the child from foster home to foster home, and pretty soon it brings upon that child's identity that they're a bad person. And they incorporate that image into their own self-concept. And then they tend to act that way. And so we're simply reinforcing negative self-concepts by punishment. And then there's a school that promotes a model of behavior change called behavior modification that has been around pretty much for the last 50 or so years in this century. But the research findings or laboratory findings based on behavior modification tend to point out that it seems to be more efficient to create behavior changes through manipulating rewards rather than by using punishment. And I think that's another way that punishment kind of, we lost our understanding somewhat of the uses or purposes of punishment. And also, various social changes have brought about changes in the family, so that the older model of the patriarchal family that was based on fear, and maybe the fear of physical punishment, has been replaced by mother-led families, and it's a different style of discipline. It's more based on emotional give and take, or the withholding and granting of love, rather than physical pain. Maybe your fathers tell you the same stories about what their fathers used to do to them. And when they were bad, my father used to say that his father had a horsewhip that he hung by the basement stairs, and occasionally you'd have to go get that horsewhip and take it to my dad. You know, well, I as a father, I consider that possibility is really out of the realm of possibility. I don't see how I could use that kind of punishment in this day and age. Somebody, I'm sure, would call the police, who would call the welfare department. Somebody would come out and be served with a summons or something like that. And then I'd have to try to say, well, my dad said, you know, he turned out okay, I think. Well, what is the proper use of punishment? And I wanted to ask the question, can it be both morally, or can be used both morally right and also be productive of the ends that we seek, the ends being modifying behavior, specifically criminal behavior. There's actually two historic uses of punishment. Then there's one that came along in more modern times. But the two basic uses of punishment have been either as a means to an end, in other words, using punishment to affect behavior, or to bring about desired behavior, or prevent undesired behavior, or punishment as an end in itself. And punishment as an end in itself is maybe the oldest, in that maybe it even precedes the idea of society. Sigmund Freud dealt with this issue of the origins of society, and some of his theory, I don't want to go into that, but it's the idea that the social order is different than the natural order. In other words, if we look at the way animals pair up or go in herds and so on, there's a repeating of that style of organization within the species, that it's repeated no matter where one finds that species. But in human societies, you find different social orders, and these are maintained by punishment or obedience, punishment in service of obedience. But before that, there's this idea of morality, that the right and wrong, that I'm sure that way back when, humans saw that somehow, you know, you can't violate the precepts of Mother Nature. You know, if you don't plant when you're supposed to plant, if you don't help out, and if you don't do the religious rituals to bring about the proper growth of crops or to help the hunting or something like that, then you're going to be punished for that. You're going to be punished by not by starving, or you've not followed the proper processes to create what's needed for the society. And I think that's the oldest form that one finds in the Bible too, because if you start with the story of Adam and Eve and the story of the fall of Adam and Eve. The punishment that God meets out there is very clearly in terms of retribution. It's not the kind of obedience for punishments. It's not the punishment for obedience. And if you read those lines, it's very clear that, okay, you've done this, now you will suffer this because of that. And it's like a contract, like a basic contract. You know, if you act this way, then these will be the results. And in a way, it comes down to us through even the golden rule. If you treat people in a certain way, you're treating them as you expect to be treated. So, and one finds this retribution notion many places throughout the Bible. There's the beginning parts of Amos. If you want to know about God's retribution, read the first chapter of Amos, where he lists the sins of all the various societies that area of the world at that time, and what they've done wrong, and what the retribution is going to be for what they've done wrong. There's this in the New Testament, you find the people coming to Jesus and asking them about the blind man. Why is this man blind? His father must have done, he's blind from birth, so his father must have done something wrong. In other words, it seems to be a natural law, retribution. It's something that we understand at a very early age. It seems to be a law of nature, that you can't go against Mother Nature kind of thing, or you'll suffer for it. The Immanuel Kant brought the same notion into his categorical imperative, or the basis of morality, that we should act in such a way that we wish it to be a general law that all people act this way. So in a way, punishment in terms of retribution is saying, okay, you have a right to behave however you want to, and you also have a right then to be punished for the way that as a response to the way that you've acted. That's the sign that of the freedom you have as an individual. The uses of this kind of punishment are basically sacred uses in history. And I also want you to see how it seems that that there's been a progress in our understanding of punishment in some senses, in that we don't punish the way that we used to. Beheading is rarely done anymore, but used to be a somewhat of a common kind of punishment. But it was the idea, I think, that people were beheaded because of some connection between the head and the soul. That there was the idea that if you kill a person, their spirit can come back and haunt you. And so the spirit will seek vengeance. And primitive people still have this idea that there's these spirits around, maybe they're right, that are not satisfied, are not at rest. And so we have to undergo rituals of one sort or another to keep those spirits from coming back and seeking vengeance on us for what we've done. And I think beheading originally was understood in this sense, that the body was dead, you cut off the head and buried it someplace else away from the body, and somehow you were separating the soul that way and preventing it from rejoining itself. Stoning is a common form of punishment that one finds among primitive peoples too. It's sort of a group-related kind of punishment. The stone, was the first weapon. And when someone violates some of the understandings of proper behavior in the community, then the vengeance comes through a group activity of stoning. Crucifixion also avoids. You see, crucifixion was a way of avoiding the death itself, of committing the death itself. The person was hung out. And then they died of natural causes, in this manner, so that there was no real executioner in this sense. Drowning, burying people alive, I was going to read you a description of burning at the stake, just so that you could. I think a lot of us don't understand that this may have been the vilest and maybe the worst kind of punishment ever. The Inquisition brought a new type of punishment into being. The Spanish and Italian Inquisitions went on for 5 centuries, and they did a lot of burning of heretics. And what they were trying to do was, of course, emulate on earth the kind of eternal punishment that one would meet in hell. You know, you burn in hell. So, okay, let's burn them before they get to hell, you know, so that, you know, we can all understand what that would be like, and that they deserve this for their heresy. I have a description of the burning of the Bishop of Gloucester for heresy in the 1500s, and it's just a horrible description. You can imagine, if you think of a piece of meat on a spit turning, you know, and watching the fat drip into the fire, and it finally being, if you don't forget to take it off the fire, it finally gets consumed. Some people would try to help the burning person avoid the pain by putting charges of gunpowder under them so that when the fire would hit the gunpowder, it would explode and maybe that would kill them, and so that they wouldn't suffer the pain. But then to watch the bottom part of the body burn and the top part of the body still is alive. And then you have people standing around watching this sort of thing. In the note, you notice, I don't know if you can sense this, but in the notice, in the punishment for retribution or vengeance, this, if we're considering this to be a moral basis for punishment, then it's not exactly moral to punish people for deterrence purposes along these lines, because that's the use of punishment for another end. If we think, well, some people are especially horrendous criminals, and so they deserve more punishment than other people for the same crime. You see, then we're picking out these people and saying, look, we're going to punish those persons maybe as a model for the rest of us, as an example for the rest of us. That's strictly immoral along these lines. Also, punishing a person to prevent them from repeating the behavior is also an immoral use of punishment, if we're thinking of preserving the moral order or punishing for moral purposes. The other kind of punishment then is the punishment for obedience sake, the use of punishment as a means for correction. And this again probably is, as I said, it goes back to the very basis of society. The social order is not possible without punishment. Whatever the systems are that we're talking about, whether they're family systems or government systems, economic systems, within each of those systems there's a particular order, an order of inequality. And that order of inequality is maintained through punishment and the seeking of obedience. When the state takes over punishment, up to a point, you see, before the development of government in the state, people have a moral duty to avenge a crime, family feuds or blood feuds. The victim will not rest until his or her soul is avenged for the murder. There's a feeling of uncleanness until the vengeance takes place. However, with the development of the state and the taking over punishment by the state, you see the state takes over these blood feuds or takes the part of the victim in seeking the vengeance. But you have to really ask the question, whose interest is this punishment in terms of? Is it to serve the interests of the state, to justify the existence and legitimize the state, or is it really taking the part of the victim in this process? And I think we have to see that punishment by the state, by the government, is in much more in terms, it may be justified as vengeance, but it certainly seems to be practiced more in terms of establishing a particular social order and maintaining a system of inequality in the society. The public executions would probably be a good example of this. This is a very, in Western civilization, especially in England in the 16th century, in the 15s to the 1700s, public executions were a very common form of public ritual. And they in the 1600s, England had 411 capital crimes. And the it's very interesting, historians go back and see who got the death penalty, who didn't. And with the early development of the state, and about that time, modern crime comes into existence too. And by modern crime, I mean these modern criminal professions that heretofore at this time didn't really exist except in really minor forms, but where there are things like pickpocketing, prostitution, and so on, as large-scale enterprises and occupations that are passed on and techniques that are taught, highwaymen, and so on, develop in England about this time too, in the Elizabethan era. And it seems to be because of the social changes that were taking place that kicked the peasants off the land. The land became, with the development of cities, the land became much more valuable in terms of agricultural production and in terms of sheep grazing. And peasants were displaced off the land. They didn't have any place to go. Some of them went to the city. Some of them dissolved into the woods and became known as highwaymen. Others went to the cities and learned deviant trades. And as an attempt to wipe these out, there was many laws passed that promoted or were capital kinds of offenses to execute these people as examples to others. And psychologists really wondered about this, that one of the things that they would always point out is that while a pickpocket was being hung up there, there were pickpockets circulating in the crowds, you know, lifting people's wallets. And of course, the reason for that is that the pickpocket depends on diversion, you know, as a major manner of being successful in their trade. But they developed a carnival atmosphere. John and Charles Wesley would use these executions as a form of conversion. They would get out there and there would start with a parade from the prison to the gallows, and the people would follow along, and the bands would be playing, and people would be selling popcorn and beer in the crowd. And these people were heroes. You see, they were like the gladiators in a sense that were being executed. I don't see if you understand this, but at this particular time, when there's no life to look forward to for so many people, their one moment of glory may be this, where they become a social hero, may be as this person being executed. And the John and Charles Wesley would be up there in some of these cases preaching and giving these fire and brimstone sermons. And the idea was to build the crowd's emotion just to the point where the trap door would open up and the person would go down. And they would culminate, that would be the climax of the sermon at that point. And then the idea was that people were supposed to repent and from their sins and at that particular time. Well, there was a lot of exploitation of this. And over time, these systems became rationalized, legal systems became rationalized, and this kind of punishment and the variation in the kind of punishment became much more stable, and the equality under the law became an ethic that was at the basis of the reformulation and renovation of these legal systems. In terms of morality, then, you see, we can say that this kind of punishment is moral if it supports a moral social system. You see, if this, you can think of, there's many different kinds of societies, and there's punishment in those societies for many different reasons. Are those forms of punishment and those uses of punishment promoting a just and moral social system? If they are, then maybe we can say that kind of punishment is moral. If not, and it's difficult to see how a system of inequality that's being promoted by this kind of punishment would be moral in most cases. Now, in our system, what we use as a justification for going along with our system is basically equal protection under the law. If there's equal protection under the law, and if there's equality of opportunity in the society, then the system of inequality that exists is justified. You see, if, do you understand that point? Yes.
Then in the movie we saw that was promoting an immoral system.
That's right.
It was immoral.
Right.
Because it wasn't promoting equality.
Well, it was promoting a system of exploitation. Okay, so you see these two purposes of punishment, one to create and maintain a social order, without which society collapses. And on the other hand, the use of punishment to promote and preserve a moral order, which is superior to and above the social order. Now, I think we can use that as a means of criticizing the social system, and we do. Obviously, if a person is wealthy and they use their wealth for good, and we say, well, that wealth has not been ill-gotten, they didn't steal it from somebody else, then maybe it's morally justified the way that they have gained and used their wealth. But we run into a lot of problems with this if we try to achieve equal opportunity. How are we going to do that without taking away from some people? Especially if you think of the problem of inheritance. And I think that's what, in socialist systems, that's the first thing that goes by the wayside. Why should some people start off with a lot more than other people? What justified that? It can be justified, but it also is a means of critiquing the system. Okay, so the question then, coming up to modern times and into our dilemmas in modern society, is how are our laws used and how is punishment used in our society? Is it used equally? We could use punishment to equalize things in society. And the way we could do that is by punishing rich people a lot more than we punish poor people. You know, a rich person commits a crime and we give them twice as the penalty as we do a poor person. But you know, that's not going to come about because that would not preserve the social order. That will come about if there's a revolution. And that is what happens in a revolution. You think of, for example, the French Revolution, which would be a good example of that, or modern socialist revolutions.
How would that be rationally related to the crime? For instance, if a rich person kills his spouse, as compared to a poor person kills their spouse, what would be the rational relationship that their economic status would dictate they'd be punished at a greater level?
This would be to try to equalize punishments.
That wouldn't equalize punishment, because if you take one hand, tell me how it would equalize punishment.
Well, maybe not equalize punishment so much. I didn't mean that. I meant equalize the social order, the relationships within the society. In other words, a penalty of $50 to a poor person would obviously be a lot more than $50 to a rich person.
Well, that goes directly against the whole idea of racial equality, that when they used to have rules that blacks would have a certain requirement greater than whites would have, you'd be using that same type of analogy to wealth.
Right. And
apparently we don't allow that to happen in this country.
Right, I think you're right. I think there's a problem there. I don't think that would be a moral use of punishment. Because if we're thinking in terms of vengeance and retribution, we have to say that if one person commits a crime that's similar in gravity to another person's crime, then they should receive the same punishment response. That would be what is moral. If we punish this rich person a lot more for committing the same crime, then we're violating moral precepts. And we're also then, although we may be trying to reverse the social order, which is on a different level.
A comment about the revolution, or your comment, unless there is a revolution.
Or that's one way you can tell that a revolution has taken place.
I'd like to just comment about what took place in Nicaragua, though, and having visited some of the prisons there, that the Minister of Interior, who had lost, whose wife and child was also killed by the National Guardsmen, after the revolution took place, someone said we should kill all those who were part, or the officials of the National Guard, and he was the one who said, no, we are to forgive them. And what they have done as far as in their reform program in the prison is what I consider grace. They released most of the National Guardsmen and let them go on their merry way, but the officials are being trained in a skill area. The prisons were not like our prisons here in this country, and they were very free and very, what I would consider, grace to
certainly
those people. So here is a situation where the rich and the poor were struggling.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I haven't been to Nicaragua, but from what I've read, it's exactly how you say it is. These are incredible stories. What is the fellow's name who's the Minister of Interior?
Is it Soda?
I can't remember right now. But it's just amazing what his response. I was reading this article too, and he said he came to the prison where the man was that had tortured him while he had been locked up for years. And he said, now we're in, our positions are reversed. Now you're in prison and I'm out of prison. Now I've come to seek my vengeance. He says, my vengeance is I forgive you. You can go. That's obviously not the kind of, the uses of punishment that I'm talking about here.
I think that raises an interesting point for the religious community if you're talking about, sounds like it could be termed a punishment of retribution as opposed to a punishment of reconciliation or dealing with something as reconciliation. And I think there, within the criminal justice work that I've done, there are people within the religious community who are talking about criminal justice in that way,
mm-hmm.
and talking about victims as well as offenders and causes underlying crimes.
This, I think we have to realize this. See, I haven't made this distinction yet, but I might as well move to it since this has been brought up, that what I've been talking about so far is a punishment that's moral or immoral, and in terms of what it serves, which system it serves. But when we bring Christian responses into this, or Christian obligations into this, we're talking about something totally different. And what does our Christianity teach us about this? Now, the cycle of vengeance and retribution is, of course, as old as the Garden of Eden. And lots of us don't realize this, though, that these hardcore criminals are committing their crimes out of vengeance. You know, the story didn't start with them, and their act. The story goes back a little further, and the way that maybe their families or they were treated as children, to be cast out on the streets at an early age, to be rejected by society and one's parents, may create a severe sense of that something, that one has done something wrong to me, that I have suffered, and this hatred that may build up, that spills over eventually, is not stopped by the act of punishing that criminal for that act. That person sits in prison, and the anger grows. To bring it to something that maybe we're more acquainted with, to switch levels totally, something to do with weight loss, for example. Most of us have experienced going on a diet, and we lose some pounds, and then we gain it right back again, and we feel bad about that. So we go back on the diet again, then we gain the weight right back again. What's happening? Well, we're punishing ourselves for what we've done before. We've overeaten, we drank too much, we ate too much, we feel guilty, we suffer, we've gained weight. So we put ourselves in jail, and the diet is jail. And then we sit there and we stew, then we get angry, and then we break out of jail. And then we feel guilty again, and then we put ourselves back in jail again. Well, that cycle is going on with the criminal and punishment too. And who or where does it stop? It has to something has to break into that cycle someplace. And as Paul tells us in Hebrews, this is what Jesus did, was to come into history and try to break into that cycle and take that evil onto himself and not pass it on to the next person. And this is, of course, something very difficult for us to do without spiritual help of one sort or another. And maybe most of us probably can't do it or would find it very difficult to do. There's a case where I come from in Oakland. One of the local ministers in the black community was starting a campaign against the drug dealers in the community. And so his congregation was going out to the street corners where a lot of the selling was going on, and by their appearance there, and they were trying to curtail the drug activity. And one of the drug dealers got all incensed because, you know, I'm sure, Oakland is a predominantly black city or minority city, and black teenagers especially look to the drug trade as just a source of income. It's and that's all it is. You know, they're little entrepreneurs. They know all about business. They know about weights and measures and about profit and loss, and they're very clear about these things. And this is how they make their money. They're spending money. And the rest of us look on this as some horrible, immoral thing that they're turning these kids on to drugs and so on. But they're just, to them, they're doing business. Well, anyways, one of these drug dealers got all incensed and came into the church one day and went into the minister's study and threatened him and said, "Look, if you don't call off those people, we're going to get you." And so the minister, of course, got pretty scared, and he called the police, and so they arrested this guy, and his name happened to be Willie Smith. And so the congregation got together, and they said, "Well, you know what we should do, rather than just see this guy get carted off to jail, because he's going to come back here, and he's probably going to be angrier next time, we ought to minister to this person." And so they went down to the jail, and they convinced the authorities, the police, to let Willie go, and that the congregation would take care of him. So at this point, Willie, you know, to make a long story short, that was about 2 years ago. Well, within a year, Willie Smith is one of the assistant ministers in that church, and goes around, you know, as a professional ex-addict or something like that. He goes around and gives talks about, you know, the evils of drugs. This is, again, another way of showing how the Christian system of moral understanding is not really the same as just doing right, you know, doing right by the world's standards. Doing right by the world's standards has to do with retribution and vengeance. And we can't deny that. We can't say, "Look, you shouldn't do this just because it's wrong, you know, or does it." It's a basic moral fact that most of the world goes along with. Does anybody else have anything they'd like to contribute about that?
For instance, in Nicaragua, where the role was reversed and the man who is now free had been the victim, that the person he forgave thought on it and mulled it over a great deal more, the fact that retribution was not dealt to him, than if he had been punished in some way and could say, "Well, he got even, forget it. Now there is no even that he knows of, and so he's going to be wondering."
I think that's probably the purpose. I wish I could remember the fellow's name. Does anybody remember his name? Who's the minister of interior?
Descoto.
Oh.
It's
I'm thinking of a different person, I guess.
You're talking about a variety of different
people. Oh, I'm thinking of the Minister of Culture. I'm sorry, go ahead.
You were Nicaragua or Guatemala, which is Nicaragua. Are you talking about a political crimes as opposed to what you first started with pickpockets and prostitution, which was around during the New Testament? Because it must have been pretty prevalent if they're recorded in the Gospels. And there's two different types of crimes you're referring to, if you want to call them that. And the punishment is somehow different too, I believe, because what in one state might be a political crime one week after a revolt would not be a crime. So we're talking about injustice against a person, injustice against a way of thinking or something. How do you go about dealing with types of punishment that are allowed for different types of crimes?
Well, I mentioned earlier the Inquisition. The Inquisition brought about a whole different use of punishment, and that was punishment to exact confessions.
Tale of Two Cities. I mean, look at that. That's almost a mirror.
Right. But what I was getting at was that there's a use of punishment to exact a confession, you know, to get people to admit to having done something wrong. Now, I think, you know, as parents, we understand this when we discipline our children. It's not just enough to discipline your children. You want your child to say, yes, I know what I did was wrong. Because it's hard, you know, to punish them and they say, what I did was not wrong. But, you know, I don't care how much you punish me, it wasn't wrong. And you say, I want something more than that. I want them to assert, you know, or align themselves with my particular system of rights and wrongs by confession. And this was what the Inquisition was doing, was locking people up and torturing them to exact confessions. Now, what happened to them after the confession may or may not have been too important. It may have been really important in terms of, you know, some people got burned at the stake, but some people may have just been exiled. And we find this too coming down in modern systems also, where for example, the People's Republic of China, the idea of re-educating criminals rather than punishing them. You know, you sort of lock them up and re-educate them until they align themselves with the social order that exists and assent to that. And so I think, you know, that this may be in Nicaragua, I don't know exactly what's going on there, but it wouldn't make too much difference whether it's a political crime or what we call a sort of a normal crime, everyday crime of stealing or assaulting someone else. The idea is to re-educate that person.
Premised on their being guilt still a part of that person.
Or they're feeling guilt, right.
Yeah, but does that premise hold throughout repeating criminal offense?
Well, I wanted to say something about prisons. Question comes up, you know, many of us may have thought about this, what is the effect of prison punishment? And I tried to get at this a little earlier in saying that maybe it engenders anger, you know, in a lot of people who are locked up. That the problem with locking people up is that they're separated from the influence of the rest of society. And they only have the influence of themselves. This is also what we do when we take youth out of our society and segregate them into schools. They're separated from adult influence and just have themselves, or people in ghettos too, same way. And once you do that, you develop these antagonistic relationships between these groups. And so there's an ideology in prison that is very antisocial and that justifies crime. And that when we talk about prisons as schools for crime, many of us think of maybe it's talking about techniques like how to blow a safe, you know, or something like that. But really, the education is in terms of learning justifications for criminal ways of life. And so if people who are sent to prison have strong attachment to legitimate society, then they may be affected by prison in the sense that they never want to come back. They may be the kind of person in prison who makes a really good adjustment. You know, they go along with the authorities, the administration in the prison, and so on. But prisons tend to be filled with people who don't go along with the system, who feel they're selling out to their peer group if they go along with the system. and prisons tend to reinforce those attitudes. It's hard to see punishment, criminal punishment in terms of prison, changing people's attitudes because of the way that it's administered. We think about punishment that works best is swift punishment, certain punishment, severe punishment. But the kind of criminal punishment we hand out doesn't really achieve any of these ends. It's many cases not swift. From the criminal act to the finally the person going to prison may be a long period of time, and a lot of things happened within that time. It's not so certain. You know, if you think about what your chances are of getting caught for committing a crime, let's say that you wanted to commit a crime, and so you planned it and case to place and things like that, you do it in such a way that you wouldn't get caught. So maybe prisons are filled with dumb criminals. But what are the odds on getting caught? It depends on the time and the circumstances, but they may be pretty low. And what are the odds of being sent to prison if one is caught for a crime? Again, they may be pretty low too. There's the percentage of crimes cleared by somebody going to prison varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but it's only about 1 or 2%. I wanted to get to this in another session. You have to ask yourself, well, if that's true, then who do we send to prison? Who does end up there? And who doesn't end up there? Let me finish this section on, or the statements I wanted to make on the morality of punishment by pointing out that if our goal is to achieve and maintain the social order and also to promote a moral order, equality of punishments probably is the way to do it. Because if we administer punishments equally, then those people who are lower in the social order suffer more than those who are higher in the social order, which promotes the social order and maintains it. And also we're promoting this moral ideal of the contract of retribution by doing that. And if we want to achieve those social and moral ends, what we're going to have to do is to scale down our criminal punishments a great deal, maybe to come in line with most countries in the rest of the world. We keep adding on, you know, when legislators decide about reforming prisons, they don't want to be accused by their constituency of being soft on crime. So when they make decisions, how do you decide how much time in prison to attach to a particular crime? There's no yardstick. And I think that legislators then don't want to be caught saying, well, we were too soft, so they always add a little bit to what was there previously, and that's how these sentences kind of get escalated. We're also going to have to change the conditions that exist in prisons. The penal code says if you commit this particular type of act, which is defined, you receive a certain sentence within a certain range or a certain fine. It doesn't say what happens after that. You know, what happens to somebody who's sent to one of these hellacious types of prisons versus somebody who does time on the county farm is released into the community on parole? There's vast differences in the kind of punishment that takes place depending on where a person's sent and how they do their time. Now, these prisons tend to be, especially large prisons, tend to be unmanageable. This last year I was involved with a suit that inmates at San Quentin in California brought against the state of California under the Eighth Amendment of cruel and inhuman punishment. And they've got us a U.S. Appeals Court judge to hear the case, and in San Francisco. And so the inmates' side, the lawyers, needed expert witnesses to go into these prisons and describe the conditions, and so I was chosen. And so I got to visit parts of San Quentin that I had never seen before, because each year I take a class to visit San Quentin, but they only show us, they don't show us the whole prison. But to see the sections where they don't take the students, to see people locked up 24 hours a day in cells that are 40 square feet, two people in a cell. And you know, that's like 4 by 10. And they just sit there all day. The stench and the vermin that are running around. All of these things that you know, we would really turn your stomach to see. They can't, even by these means, they can't stop the violence or the corruption that exists in these places. You can still get any kind of drug you want. The violence rates are 40 times the rates on the outside. It seems to promote the problem more than it solves it. We really have to start paying attention to those types of things if we want to justify the way we handle criminals and the kind of punishments we use. The kind of violence that exists in prison is due to the putting all men together in this kind of situation where they have to live with one another 24 hours a day. If you think about this, if you walk down the street and somebody affronts you, like where I live, they call it the world's largest outpatient clinic, Berkeley, California. And the, you know, you walk down the street and you see people talking to themselves and they're coming towards you. And sometimes, you know, there's this guy that walks down the street and swears at everybody that passes him, you know, and calls them names. And, you know, you're not expecting that kind of thing. But, you know, you can dismiss it and say, well, that guy's crazy. I don't have to deal with him in the next minute, you know, or even the rest of my life if I don't want to. But in prison, if somebody affronts you, you're going to have to live with that person daily and see that person daily, every minute. And if you don't, if you don't take vengeance, you know, if you don't respond, then you're labeled as a weak person, and the exploitation that you'll undergo is much worse. And so the slightest affront has to be met with the utmost retaliation. One of my friends who did a lot of time told me one time, was visiting him in a prison that he had just been assigned to, and he said, he was telling me what had happened to him, and he said, well, he says, the first day I walk into my cell, there's a pack of Marlboros sitting on my cot. And he says, well, what do I do now? And so he sat down, and he says, well, I know what I'll do. So he sat down and he smoked the pack of cigarettes. And then he was walking, that later that afternoon, he was walking down the hall, and fellow came up to him and he says, hey, do you like those cigarettes I gave you? And he says, yeah, and he hauled off and hit him as hard as he could and knocked his teeth out. Because if he had acknowledged the gift, then he would have acknowledged that he was subservient to this fellow and would have to you know, take his, do whatever this guy wanted him to do. And he also had to give a visible sign to everybody else that he was not going to stand for that kind of thing. So you see, yeah, I think that the kind of conditions that these kinds of conditions of confinement that promote those kinds of things have to be dealt with.
What is the idea of prison?
Well,
or alternative.
Well, for one thing, not keeping these people so together at all for such long periods of time, building up a prison culture. What's the corruption? Well, that. But then you also have to scale down the sentences. For, you know, like let's say, you know, for example, burglary. You know, a person does 8 months in isolation or 6 months, something like that, and then they're released, and it's a certainty that they're going to do this thing. There's the use of prison to deter crime. Well, I don't want to deal with that. But then there's the kind and variety of prisons besides the prisons that are not so isolated from the community. prisons that allow prisoners to interact with elements within the community. Yes?
Isn't one of the factors, though, the fear that we in society have of people running around Washington, which is moving to a determinate sentencing from indeterminate, and there seems to be a lot of fear that the rapists and the whatevers are going to be running around much too soon. How do we deal with that factor of fear that we have? It's almost like you're up behind bars.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I don't think that we can expect. You're talking. You know, talking about it, us in this room or we in the society, I think it's a general rule that we can't deal, you know, I want to say this, we can't deal with these problems until we deal with the general living conditions in our society to begin with. Because I don't think that as a general rule, or maybe even, you know, a proposition, that people will stand for prisoners being treated than the worst segment of society is already treated. In other words, if you have people living in slum conditions in our society, how do you justify treating prisoners better than that? In other words, do you see the point I'm getting at?
For some prisoners, they've never been treated so well.
That's right. But also, people don't think it's right. You know, if you give job training, occupational training to prisoners, then why should you have to commit a crime and get sent to prison to get occupational training? Why don't we give it to people before they get to prison? Probably the society that treats its prisoners the best in the world is Sweden. And you also see Swedish society as being much more advanced in terms of the general standard of living of the entire society. So you see the principle at work in that case.
I'm curious, you're advocating really the humanization of the way in which we deal with the criminal element in our society. How would you as a sociologist explain the increased humanizing that has taken place over the last 500,000 years?
Well, that's a good question. You know, a lot of people wonder about whether there's progress in civilization this way, but I think when we look at punishment, we have to realize that there has been something that's happened. My father was telling me that when he was a kid, it was okay to if you owned a horse, you could beat it to death if you wanted to. And, you know, it was a bad acting horse or something. And that nobody would do anything about it. And it probably is even later than that, you could do that to your wife, not to death, but... it was in English common law and American law, it was justified to beat a wife in order to keep her in the home. Only the English law said you couldn't use a stick that was wider than your thumb to beat your wife with. And, you know, and this is up into the late 1800s, and almost into this century. And it's this idea that, you know, the patriarchal family, you've got to keep those wives there. And how are you going to keep them there if they don't want to be there? Well, you have to have a social support system, the state that supports keeping them there any means that's possible. So now we think of, you're right, we don't look at these things as being moral any longer. You know, our consciousness has been raised.